rewrites the rules to create entirely new worlds of sound. Where will you be on Mondays at 8 when the door slams shut? Here on KBOO Portland.
This KBOO program is made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Wilkin & Company, PC, Certified Public Accountants, helping businesses, individuals, and nonprofit organizations make financial decisions based on their personal values since 1987. Wilkin & Company is located at 2435 Southwest 5th Avenue in Portland. Information at 503-225-1359 or wilkincpas.com.
Good morning and welcome to Locus Focus. I'm Barbara Bernstein, your host for this weekly conversation about our place on the planet. While the fate of the controversial Keystone XL pipeline is caught in a fury of politics and headlines, last month the United States quietly approved another major border crossing pipeline proposal. Kinder Morgan's Cochin Pipeline has been operating since 1979 between Fort Saskatchewan, Alberta, and Windsor, Ontario, carrying various forms of natural gas. Now Kinder Morgan will be allowed to reverse the flow and expand the Cochin Pipeline system to move condensate westbound from the new Kinder Morgan Cochin Terminal in Illinois to existing terminal facilities in Alberta. This condensate, derived from fracking the Eagle Ford Shale Basin in Texas, is used to dilute the bitumen in the tar sands. This morning we talk with Calgary-based environmental writer Andrew Nikiforuk about how the Cochin Pipeline Project reveals the connections between fracking for natural gas in the United States and booming tar sands development in Alberta. Andrew is the author of several books, including Tar Sands and the Energy of Slaves. Andrew, welcome back to Locus Focus.
My pleasure, Barbara. How are you?
I'm just fine, and Happy New Year to you, and Happy New Year to all the listeners.
Well, likewise.
And this seems to be a season of deception. I was thinking how we've had all this focus on the Keystone XL pipeline, and then I saw an article just a few weeks ago about the Cochin pipeline, which I'd never heard of, just kind of slipping through approval. At the same time, we are experiencing a series of megaloads going through Oregon, carrying huge water purifying processors up to the tar sands development. And now they're going through Oregon to kind of slip through the parts of Idaho that were more controversial. So I want to kind of start by talking about how, let's say, the disconnect between what is controversial, what's in the public eye about tar sands development and its relating infrastructure and tentacles, and the kinds of things that seem to be slipping on by.
Well, I think, I mean, when you mention the word deception, the really big deception has to do with the quality of the crude we're talking about. And bitumen is a junk crude. It's a very poor grade of oil. And when you start becoming dependent on hydrocarbons that are much more extreme and much more difficult to produce, this has all kinds of implications, you know, for your economy, for your politics, as well as for the environmental footprint of these operations. So the big deception that has taken place really for the last decade is that somehow, you know, fracked oil or bitumen from northern Canada is going to somehow make the world a much better and safer place, and that we don't have to worry about depleting oil supplies in any regard. And that's completely false, because whether we're talking about fracking tight oil in the Bakken, or whether we're talking about mining the forests in northern Alberta to produce bitumen, we are doing something qualitatively different, and we're employing more money, more energy, we're getting less back, and what we're actually getting is quite in many cases of a very different or lower quality, bitumen in particular. And even the light oil from the Bakken has huge problems associated with it. And in fact, you know, there was the department, U.S. Department of Transportation, issued an alert last week saying, you know, there's something going on with this Bakken oil. It seems to be much more explosive and much more flammable than conventional oils. So that's the first big issue here, is that we've got a problem and we don't want to recognize it. And that problem is that we are trying to switch from conventional hydrocarbons, which were cheap and abundant at one time, to these extreme and difficult hydrocarbons, which are not cheap, and which are also driving enormous energy sprawl. In other words, it takes more infrastructure, it takes more complexity, it takes more a larger environmental footprint, more water usage, more energy usage to produce these hydrocarbons. And with the result that, you know, you end up cannibalizing other aspects of your economy, as well as your politics, because, you know, every single, you know, at this point in time seems to be, we have to produce these resources, we have to get them out of the ground, we have to build these new pipelines, and this kind of frantic mentality has replaced any opportunities for reflections about, well, wait a moment, where the hell are we going, and can we make this switch from conventionals to unconventionals? And what does it mean? And what will be the costs? And who's going to pay them? And is this actually making us less secure or more secure as a continent?
Well, I've been thinking a lot the last few days about the whole concept of difficult oil, which is a term that's used not only by people like you, but also by people within the oil industry, oil geologists who recognize that it's difficult to get this oil. But it seems like it's not just the oil that's difficult, but there's also a lot of difficulty in all the infrastructure. And it brings me to these megaloads that they're now hauling through Oregon. And it says something to me that they are now taking these trucks carrying, and the trucks is a very loose word for what these conveyances are. It's the same kind of conveyances that moved the Sellwood Bridge last year here in Portland, and the same company. But they are they're taking them about 500 miles out of the way. I mean, it's really circuitous route, basically because of politics, terrain, geography, and politics, I think, and legal issues, because they're prevented from going a more direct route through Idaho now. And it seems to me that everything is difficult about extracting difficult hydrocarbons. And I think it seems like it comes to a head up in Alberta, where you see the extreme damage up there.
Well, what we're seeing is just that we've ramped up the level of complexity tremendously. All right, let's just take bitumen as an example. All right, so, you know, a lot of listeners are probably wondering, well, why the hell do we need to take ultralight oil or condensate that has been produced in the Eagle Ford Shale in southern Texas along the border of Mexico? Why do we have to pipe that light oil across the United States into Canada to help bitumen production? What is that about? Well, what it is showing, again, is the low quality of bitumen itself. So what is bitumen? Bitumen is it's this junk crude. It was at one time light oil. It's been badly degraded by bacteria over tens of millions of years, and as a result, it's been reduced to this really thick molasses-like stuff. So it's rich in carbon. It's very poor in hydrogen. Bitumen, once you've mined it out of the ground, is so thick and so viscous that it will not move through a pipeline. So unless you dilute it with something, you can't ship it anywhere. So you need about one barrel of condensate to move 3 barrels of bitumen. In other words, and the condensate kind of acts like a solvent or a paint thinner, and it thins that bitumen to the point where it will move through a pipeline. So Canada's big problem at the moment is that, you know, we're producing more than 2 million barrels of bitumen a day, but we don't have enough condensate. We're short of condensate to move this stuff.
Actually, let's talk a bit more about what is condensate, because this is a new term to a lot of people.
Well, condensate is a industry slang for ultralight oil, okay, and stuff that has the properties essentially of gasoline or of a paint thinner. It's highly volatile, highly explosive stuff, and it is produced in a lot of tight oil fields. So there's a lot of condensate production in the Bakken, in in North Dakota, and a lot of condensate production in the Eagle Ford Shale in Texas. And the biggest markets for that, for the condensate, and condensate, by the way, sells much more than a barrel of oil. So the average price for a barrel of condensate at the moment is $108. So and this stuff is extremely valuable, and that's why industry is going after it in a big way. And then you've got the Canada's bitumen industry, which is extremely dependent on condensate imports, largely at the moment from the United States, but also from elsewhere, to move their bitumen. So when here we have evolved from over the last 100 years from the point where most oil that we were producing was light and we could just pump it out of the ground, move it through a pipeline. Thank you very much, without a hell of a lot of trouble. And now we've reached the point where the quality of the crude is so poor that we actually have to dilute it with much more valuable mixtures of hydrocarbons in order to get it anywhere. And once we've get it to the refinery, then we've got to strip out that condensate, because it's valuable stuff, before we can begin the refining process itself. So, that means then we need more pipelines. It means we need another product. We need, we've created more markets, and it's a classic case of energy sprawl, where your infrastructure for the production of hydrocarbons just suddenly gets larger and more complicated and dirtier as the quality of the resource steadily declines. And this is what hydraulic fracturing is all about, too. I mean, people say, why are we doing this? Why, isn't this a great thing? Aren't we producing all this oil and gas? Well, yes, we are producing tremendous amounts of oil and gas, particularly in the United States, from this process. But Americans really need to sit down and they've got to ask themselves, okay, well, what is this all about? Why do we have to drill 2 miles underneath the ground and take millions of gallons of water and sand and toxic chemicals and pump it at extremely high pressures into the ground to break up rock formations that really have the consistency of concrete over extremely large areas, with the result that we can, create these fractures in these rocks that release hydrocarbons that either haven't been cooked enough or overcooked, and bring them back to surface. This is brute force, and it is the fact that we are doing it indicates that, again, that we've run out of the cheap stuff, and now we have to apply much more complicated, energy-intensive, and capital-intensive technologies to produce resources that of a very difficult and extreme nature that create all kinds of additional problems, whether we're talking about the incredible explosive character of tight oil from the Bakken, or whether we're talking about the incredibly expensive costs of trying to clean up diluted bitumen oil spills in places like Arkansas or Michigan. We now know that diluted bitumen, that once it spills out of the pipeline, that the condensate evaporates all of the into the air, and leaving the heavy bitumen behind, which then sinks into a waterway. And as a consequence of that behavior, the costs of cleaning up diluted bitumen are absolutely extraordinary, but nearly five times more than that of cleaning up conventional oil. I mean, conventional oil will float on top of water, but bitumen does not.
Bitumen actually sinks, right?
Bitumen actually sinks. Once the ultra light oil or gasoline like condensate mixture evaporates into the air, and when it does that, of course, it's releasing all kinds of toxic compounds. I mean, there were hundreds of people in Michigan who were hospitalized. Nearly 150 people lost their homes. Enbridge ended up buying them because of the fumes and public health hazard. So, these hydrocarbons come with a very, very high cost. So what we're seeing now is something fairly alarming in our energy system. that requires more capital, that requires more energy, it requires more complexity, and actually requires companies to frack formations in southern Texas to provide a product that helps us dilute heavy bitumen in Canada so we can export it to other places in the United States. I mean, that is an incredibly complex system that comes with all kinds of vulnerabilities.
Well, if you're just tuning in this morning, we're talking about the connections between fracking in the United States, fracking particularly for oil and also for natural gas, and the development of tar sands in northeastern Alberta. My guest is Andrew Nikiforuk, who's been writing on energy issues for many, many years. And we're talking in particular, or what stimulated this conversation for me was word that this new pipeline, or is an old pipeline, is being basically retrofitted so that it can move condensate from Texas up to Alberta. And it raises a lot of questions, and hopefully we'll make more people aware that there's a lot more going on with the tar sands than just mining bitumen. So I wanted to talk a little bit more about what condensate is and some of the specific dangers of condensate, and how it's not just an issue actually for diluting bitumen, but it's also an issue, I think, with the oil trains that are currently going through the United States.
Yeah, condensate is very volatile and very explosive stuff. It's a hazardous material. And it's not the kind of stuff that you want to see moving through your community, either by train or by pipeline, because it is that much more flammable and explosive than oil, and but that's exactly what we're seeing. We're seeing condensate moving by pipeline and also by rail in unprecedented numbers or unprecedented volume to Canada. Now, I'll just give an example. I mean, Canada needs about 330,000 barrels of condensate a day in order to mix and dilute bitumen so that it can ship bitumen to the United States. The majority of that condensate is now coming from the United States. We produce some of it here in Canada, but not enough to meet demand. We know that U.S. imports of condensate from the United States we are importing about 150,000 barrels a day, and that could go up to 700,000 barrels a day by 2025.
Now, how is the condensate produced? I mean, is it a byproduct of fracking oil, or is it just something that they actually seek in the first place?
It's generally something that you find along with your gas and with your oil. And it is what industry typically calls natural gas liquids. So when you're drilling for shale gas, let's say in the Eagle Ford, or you're drilling for tight oil in the Bakken, quite often associated with that production, you will get these very valuable liquids. And so some formations are much richer in these natural gas liquids than others. So as the price of shale gas or the price of natural gas has gone down dramatically in the last couple of years, more and more companies have shut in their shale gas production zones and have begun to focus on formations that are releasing more liquids, because these liquids are just much more valuable. So that's where this condensate is coming from.
So I actually also wanted to talk a little bit about just what the condensate is like to be around. I know that if the oil train terminal is built in Vancouver, Washington, right across the river from those of us here in Portland, that they are planning on burning off 75% to 80% of the condensate that's going to be in the oil that's, because I think they also put condensate in the oil trains. So that's a big concern, because it would just be, there'd be this stack in the industrial part of Vancouver just letting out, releasing condensate vapors into the atmosphere to poison all of us here in the Portland-Vancouver area. So what is in condensate that makes it so toxic?
Oh, that's a question, Barbara, that you would have to ask a chemist. But, I mean, there are all kinds of things in condensate. There's benzenes and ethylenes and xylenes and all sorts of nasty stuff.
Lots and lots of carcinogens.
The condensate, if you're moving bitumen by rail, you don't have to dilute that bitumen with condensate. You can move bitumen on heated rail cars. And so industry likes that because they get to save money. They don't have to buy all this expensive condensate to do that.
But my understanding, this is from talking to Matt Crow, who's with Forest Ethics up in Bellingham, Washington, and he mentioned that there is going to be a concern about separating the oil that they're shipping, and this is actually the Bakken oil, I think, is right now is coming through. But they're also concerned about tar sands oil eventually coming through here. But he was mentioning that there's a concern because they do have to separate the condensate. So I'm not exactly sure what's going on there, but I've just heard that there's some issue of condensate being connected to the oil trains as well as the pipelines.
Well, I mean, in some cases, you could have entire rail units that are just transporting condensate as well. So, I mean, and wherever you're shipping and moving hydrocarbons by rail, and you have, your transportation destination points where you're taking this stuff on and off, you have enormous number of hydrocarbons that are being vented into the atmosphere. So there's all kinds of associated concerns about just breathing that stuff and being downwind from those kinds of facilities because, quite often it stinks like hell. And a lot of the stuff that's gassing off is extremely toxic.
So let's go back to this pipeline, the Cochin Pipeline, which has actually been in existence for a long time. Mm-hmm. What do you understand about what the plans that Kinder Morgan has to basically retrofit it so that it would serve a new purpose? And I guess why would it be more valuable to be using it to ship condensate up to the tar sands than it was to be shipping various forms of liquid natural gas or natural gas liquids, I guess you should describe it, prior to that?
Well, I mean, this is an old line. It was a multi-purpose line used for a variety of things, and now they want to increase, I think, the amount of stuff that can be shipped in that line. I think something like 75,000 barrels a day to 90,000 barrels a day. What they're finding in the Eagle Ford is that they're producing more condensate than they can find markets for at the moment. There isn't a hell of a demand for condensate at a lot of the refineries in the Gulf Coast, although a lot of them do use condensate for a variety of different purposes. And in fact, there's so much condensate production at the moment that they're even, considering stripping that condensate and pulling out even more valuable components such as ethylene. So, Kinder Morgan is a huge, big company, and they've been looking around and say, okay, well, where can we get a good price for this condensate? Oh, yeah, and those Canadians, I mean, they haven't planned at all very much about what the hell they're doing. They're in terrible short supply. That means we can be part of the price squeeze here and command very high prices for this product. So it's all about the money. That's what it's all about. And it's all about this phenomenal energy sprawl where we now have hydraulic fracking, and which comes with all kinds of environmental costs from air pollution to earthquakes to groundwater contamination to land devaluation to the destruction of public roads to you name it. All of those attendant costs associated with it are now added on to the footprint of mining bitumen itself in northern Canada, which is extraordinary. This bitumen is has one of the highest carbon footprints of any hydrocarbon on the planet. I mean, it is dirty oil, if there is such a thing.
So would you be saying that the extraction and shipping of condensates to the tar sands is part of the carbon footprint of the tar sands that is probably not being computed when the oil industry in Canada is putting out their statistics about what the carbon footprint is for their operations?
I can tell you it is not being included in their statistics at all at the moment, yet it should be. The cost of extracting natural gas to produce bitumen or to transport bitumen should be part of the calculations on the full carbon footprint of bitumen production, but it's not at the moment.
Well, there's this other pipeline that's being proposed by Enbridge that would go from northern Alberta to the northern BC coast. And my understanding of this pipeline that's called the Northern Gateway Pipeline is that it's a twin pipeline. And isn't it true that like one of those pipelines would be shipping condensate from the coast back to northeastern Alberta?
That is correct, yeah. The Northern Gateway Pipeline is a dual pipeline proposal. One would ship bitumen, close to 1 million barrels a day from Fort McMurray all the way over the Rocky Mountains and to the Port of Kitimat. And then the other pipeline would be receiving condensate from Middle Eastern markets and then shipping that condensate from the Port of Kitimat all the way to Fort McMurray. We're seeing this ridiculous energy sprawl where you have a resource that is so damn poor that you have to import high-priced foreign oil in order to move it. Now, we don't necessarily have to do that had there been some better planning in Canada itself. I mean, there are a number of other products that you can dilute bitumen with, such as synthetic crude. It takes more synthetic crude to dilute the bitumen, about 50-50 mix, whereas, you know, for the condensate, you only need, you know, 1-3 mix. But
what's synthetic crude?
Now, synthetic crude is upgraded bitumen. So it is, once you've taken the bitumen out of the ground, you know, and it's, as I've mentioned, this really heavy junk crude that you can't do anything with until you upgrade it. So part of the upgrading process is taking out the carbon, some carbon, and putting in some hydrogen, enriching it, and you're doing that with natural gas, and then you end up with a product called synthetic crude, which can then actually be sent to a refinery, and so this is a much finer product, and you can dilute heavy bitumen with it. And move it through a pipeline.
So it seemed like that adding to the cost of tar sands that a certain percentage of the oil that they're extracting from the tar sands would just go back into the mining the mining operations, but it would go back into getting this oil to market.
That's right. That's right. So but there's no plan to do that in Canada. And, you know, in Canada, there is essentially no public policy on the pace and scale of bitumen development. It has all been left to oil and gas companies to decide what they're going to do and how they're going to do it. Most countries that if they had a resource like bitumen, they would say, "Now wait a moment, we got to slow down here. This resource has got all kinds of liabilities associated with it, everything from carbon to water consumption to heavy metal contamination of waterways. We better slow down, figure out some of these problems, and you know what? We better add some value to this resource. We just shouldn't be shipping this product raw, either to U.S. Coastal refineries or shipping it raw to China. We should actually be upgrading it and then refining it. And what we should be exporting, if anything, should be diesel fuel and jet fuel and gasoline. There is no public policy in regards to that. As a consequence, we then see this enormous energy sprawl taking place where, you know, you've got rail companies and pipeline companies all thinking, geez, we're going to make a fortune on this lousy, crappy product because it requires so much more infrastructure to get it to market. And not only that, it requires the production of more extreme and difficult hydrocarbons to keep the whole thing going. It's an extraordinary situation. And North Americans need to get a handle on how perilous and extreme and complicated this whole process has become. And the only people benefiting from it at the moment are oil and gas companies, and no one else is benefiting from it at all.
If you're just tuning in, we're talking this morning with Andrew Nikiforuk about the difficulties of difficult oil and our difficult economy that's being based on that. And we've been talking particularly about this pipeline that's being retrofitted. That's a cross-border pipeline between Canada and the United States called the Cochin Pipeline, run by Kinder Morgan, which was quietly approved by the Obama administration a couple months ago to allow it to reverse its course and start shipping condensate, which we've been talking about today, up to the tar sands to dilute the bitumen that is being produced up there so it can get to markets here in the Pacific Northwest. I was wondering if you see that the problems with the tar sands extraction and then a whole explosion there are actually in some ways being replicated by the development of the Bakken formation in North Dakota and the Eagle Ford shale basin in Texas. Are there similar problems, or do you think that actually the problems are that much worse in Alberta?
Well, no, I think the problems are very similar in many ways. We've got two different resources, but both of them are extreme hydrocarbons. And we've got two different booms. So you have a boom in Fort McMurray, and Fort McMurray is very much a mining town, and you have all of the associated social problems that one encounters in mining boom towns. From alcoholism to spousal abuse to traffic issues to all kinds of petty crime, massive drug trade, and all that sort of stuff. Well, you go to North Dakota, you find exactly the same signature, the same footprint that oil booms do the same stuff everywhere. And in Williston, you've got extraordinarily high crime rates, you have escalating property values, you have people that were born and lived in North Dakota all their lives now find themselves not being able to afford a home where they grew up. You have massive public infrastructure being overloaded, you have massive destruction of roadways all over the place due to heavy traffic. You have issues related to the spillage of Bakken-like crude, as well as rail explosions taking place. So in terms of production, all right. So Canada's producing about 2 million barrels of bitumen a day. The Bakken is getting close to 1 million barrels a day, and about half of that is being moved out of the state by rail. Yeah, so there are a lot of comparisons. You have both the oil and gas lobby in Canada saying, look, this is the best thing since sliced bread, and you've got the oil and gas lobby in the United States, making all the same claims about the Bakken. And you have nobody in the United States really wanting to talk about the depletion rates in the Bakken, which are extraordinary. So here you have a resource that that requires all of this energy to produce, and enormous amounts of water and chemicals and sand and fracking is a really energy capital intensive enterprise, and yet a lot of these wells are only producing a couple hundred barrels a day for a year or two, and then you just experience rapid depletion, and they dry out. So, this is a kind of a temporary phenomenon. In Canada, the resource is really extensive, but the more we mine it, the more we find that its quality is, we've mined the best stuff, and now we're going after stuff that is much more higher in carbon content and requires more energy and capital to produce. So we have got similar kind of issues developing in Canada as well.
Well,
but both plays are signatures of peak oil. What bitumen mining in Canada tells us, and what the fracked oil in the Bakken or Eagle Ford tells us, is that look, the cheap stuff is gone. We now need really complicated processes to develop these extreme and difficult hydrocarbons, and whether we've got to cut down a forest and dig it up in order to get bitumen, or whether we have to drill 2 miles below the wheat fields of North Dakota, and frack the hell out of shell formations underneath there, we've got a problem. And the problem is that the energy we use is requiring greater degrees of complexity, higher volumes of capital, greater amounts of energy, and delivering fewer and fewer energy returns.
Well, I'm thinking about the difference in the loads, the mega loads that were going through Idaho and Montana, or proposed to go through 2 years ago, which were, I understand, modules for mining equipment to do the open pit mining up in around Fort McMurray, Alberta. But the loads now are these, they're calling them water purifiers. And I wonder if you can talk about the difference in the techniques that these two different loads are being designed for.
Well, I mean, I don't know, Barbara, if I actually know that much about all of the megaloads that were going up there.
Megaloads
have included all kinds of stuff.
But currently, they're calling them water purifiers.
A lot of the stuff that originally went through Idaho was built the same way. Now, I know that most of this equipment was being made in Korea, where it is manufactured and assembled there and then taken apart and then delivered to the United States, where then, you know, goes on these trucks and then find its way to Canada. It's an example again of the complexity involved in producing these products, that you have to hire companies in Korea to manufacture all kinds of products for you. Because you don't want to pay the labor costs here.
That's changed. The loads that went through in August were manufactured in Vancouver, BC. Yeah, and now, I mean, I've been trying to track down where the current loads are coming from, because there's rumors that they're being manufactured in Portland. So they are trying to get the manufacturing closer to home, it sounds like. But my understanding is that my sense of what's being manufactured now is for the steam-assisted gravity drainage systems that you were talking about, basically the horizontal dual wells that are drilled. And it's kind of it's a sort of fracking-like process to get the really deep bitumen. But it's an indication to me that the difference in the loads that are being carried between 2 years ago and now are an indication of how much deeper they're digging now for bitumen.
Well, I think what you're pointing out here is a good one. I mean, there are two ways to produce bitumen. One is is open pit mining, and the other way is what industry slang again calls something called in situ. And so people are scratching their heads and say, in situ, what does that mean? Well, basically, what they're trying to describe is a process where you're using huge amounts of natural gas to boil water to create steam, and then you're injecting the steam at very high pressures under the ground to very deep formations of bitumen. This process has all of the problems associated with hydraulic fracturing. In fact, if you overpressurize some of these very deep bitumen deposits, in other words, if it's, say, you pump in too much steam, it's a bit like blowing up a balloon, right? And underground, and if there's too much pressure there, that pressure will come and meet the rock over the bitumen resource and can crack it. And if it cracks it, then you'll see steam coming to surface, and not just steam, but you'll see bitumen and all sorts of stuff. And that is now happening. And in fact, there was a very famous steam release just last year that is still not completely under control and in the Cold Lake area just south of Fort McMurray. So this equipment that's now coming up by megaloads to support this other form of production, the in-situ production, or what I call steam plant production, is just as complicated and just as problematic as hydraulic fracking in the plains of North Dakota or in South Texas.
Well, one last thing I wanted to talk about was regulation. I just saw a headline today that the EPA does not look like they're going to be really clamping down on fracking regulations, though an article just before that I saw listed was talking about contamination is being determined that there's fracking chemicals contaminating a bunch of water supplies. I'm trying to remember now. It may be in Texas, or it might
actually,
be.
No, it was. I saw the report, and it was a report that looked at what groundwater contamination in four states where there had been an enormous amount of fracking, right, including Texas and Pennsylvania, I think Ohio, and there was one other state. And what the report found was that there was extensive groundwater contamination in all states.
So but we're not going to be seeing a whole lot of EPA enforcement, it looks like. So as much as you've told me in the past that the United States has much better environmental protection than Canada, it seems like the EPA is definitely falling down when it comes to fracking and when it comes to oil trains and it comes to a number of different issues that we're facing.
Well, you have a number of problems with your regulators, just as we do with ours, but the Department of Transportation and the Pipeline Hazardous Material Administration has got real problems with their regulation. They're a very reactive regulator, and the EPA, it seems, has been given directions to take a more hands-off approach on hydraulic fracturing. And that's unfortunate because, the United States needs to take a very serious look at how it is regulating this process, because this is a process with all kinds of problems and all kinds of costs. And right now the costs are being borne by rural Americans and by groundwater supplies.
Well, Andrew, we're just about out of time, but it's been really great to talk to you. And I got a mention from a caller. They want to know more about your books. So I think the best thing to do is maybe send them to your website and they can see more about what you've written.
Yes, they can do that, yes.
And that is andrewnikiforuk.com?
Or just Google, if they want to Google, Energy of Slaves or Tar Sands. Those are two recent books.
And also I have links to Andrew and to his books on the Locus Focus website. So if you just go to Locus Focus, kbu.fm/locusfocus, we'll have all kinds of links for information. Also our article that was in a BC paper about the Cochin Pipeline, and we'll put some other things on if you want to learn more about what's going on with the tar sand. So thanks a whole lot for joining us, Andrew.
Thank you, Barbara.
And we've been talking with environmental writer Andrew Nikiforuk, who's author of, among other things, Tar Sands and the Energy of Slaves, which is his most recent book. And you've been listening to Locus Focus here on KBOO Community Radio. If you're just tuning in and would like to hear what you missed, or you want your friends or family to hear this show, you can listen to it online or download the audio later this afternoon on our website, kboo.fm/locusfocus. Next week, Jared Farmer, who's author of Trees in Paradise, is going to return to finish our pledge drive conversation about four of California's iconic trees. My engineer is Kate Welch. Thank you, Kate. It's always great to have you around. I'm Barbara Bernstein. We're going to go out with some music by Joni Mitchell. Thanks for listening.
And it is 11 a.m. You are tuned to KBOO in Portland, and coming right up will be Health Watch. That will be followed at 11:30 by Madness Radio. Thank you, KBOO members, for your support in 2013. We appreciate your membership. It keeps KBOO strong. We have a couple messages before we go to Dr. Naaman.
Prison Pipeline is a radio program dedicated to educating the public about the Oregon criminal justice system. Topics include incarceration and reentry, addictions and mental health, elections and laws, victims' rights, and criminal justice reform. The program presents a unique understanding of the criminal justice system, addresses the root causes of crime, and challenges the status quo. It seeks to promote awareness and activism in order to foster a safer, healthier, and more just society.
Prison Pipeline airs on Monday evenings from 6:30 to 7 p.m. on KBOO Portland. Check us out every week. If you miss an episode, you can stream it later. Just go to kboo.fm/prisonpipeline. More info about upcoming shows and events related to the prison community can be found on our Facebook page, Prison Pipeline. Be sure to like us.
The purpose of this program is not to prescribe a treatment to individuals. Listeners should consult their healthcare practitioner before attempting any treatment.
Good morning and welcome to Health Watch. I'm Dr. David Naiman, your host. Back by popular demand, we have Dr. Joel Furman back on Health Watch today. Dr. Furman is a board-certified family physician who specializes in preventing and reversing disease through nutritional and natural methods. He's on the board of directors of the American College of Lifestyle Medicine, the research director of the Nutritional Research Project of the National Health Association, and he's the creator of the Health Starts Here initiative for Whole Foods. He's the author of many best-selling books, including Eat to Live and The End of Diabetes, and he's here today to talk about his book, Super Immunity, the essential nutrition guide for boosting your body's defenses to live longer, stronger, and disease-free. Welcome back to Health Watch, Dr. Joel Furman.
Oh, thank you. Excited to be on with you today.
So, Dr. Furman, let's just start with the title of the book, Super Immunity. What is super immunity in your mind?
Well, you know, you have to juxtapose that against the fact that Americans have suppressed immunity or abnormal immunity. I'm making a radical statement here. I'm saying that the fact that almost all Americans get cancer, in other words, even the ones that die of heart attacks and strokes, if they lived long enough, they would probably get cancer as well. If we took men over the age of 70 walking down the street and biopsied their prostates and put them in a Vitamix blender and looked at all the cells, we'd find probably 90% of men over the age of 70 had prostate cancer, and 90% of women at that age have breast cancer as well. The point I'm making is that if you eat like other Americans eat, you're going to have a suppressed immune system that just leaves your body exposed to viruses, bacterial infections, not just heart disease and strokes and diabetes and obesity, but also cancer will develop in almost every American eating a diet that's 60% of calories from processed foods and approximately 30% from animal products with a mere, you know, with less than 10% of vegetation. So by super immunity, I really mean normal immunity, the immune systems that we have the right to have functioning and that we can have functioning again.